I'm sorry, an alcoholic. Through the grace of God and fellowship of people like you and sponsorship, I've been sober since February the 4th, 1964. I'm very grateful. Why wouldn't I be comfortable with this bunch? I mean, this is like Disneyland, you know? It's like all the people in my own home group. I mean, this is, you all are bad alcoholics. I know you're bad alcoholics because otherwise you'd never follow John Scott around or Cindy if she's an alcoholic or Wayne Klein or whoever, you know? I mean, it's... No, it's true. I'm a bad alcoholic. I suffer from the disease of alcoholism, and I suffer. I think there's people that have. I think that some people are just not as bad as I am at all. I mean, I think that there are people who just may be just a little bit alcoholic, you know, and so they can do a little bit AA, and they seem to be okay with that. But I am not just a little bit alcoholic. I'm a lot alcoholic, and I do a lot of AA. That's what makes me feel good. And the Al-Anons who are like suffering from Al-Anonism really badly seem to hover about us, you know, and stand ready to take care of us at any time. And, we went into Deadwood today, and we weren't getting served at lunch, and so the three alcoholics sat there waving menus like this. It's so typical. You know, we're here, hey, excuse me, you know, here we are over here. Weren't that many people in the restaurant? And the patient Al-Anon gets up and goes over and talks to the person who immediately comes and takes our order, you know. So taking care of us right down the line. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for asking me. I had to explain. You know, I would say they at home, they said, where are you going this weekend? I said, well, Paha Sapa. And they go, the Caribbean? And I said, no, South Dakota. What? Where's Paha Sapa? I said, in the Black Hills. And everybody knows where that is. But anyway, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for the basket and all of the gifts and having Eric and Jackie. Jackie actually is my, I sponsor Jackie's sponsor, and I'm pleased to do that. I have done for many years. Anyway, thank you for having us. And I had a great time with my husband coming up here. I love being with him when he's in a good mood. The other day, I don't even remember what it was, but do you ever have those days where, this is very honest, but I mean it's true, you ever have those days where you just can't be wrong? You know, you just can't be wrong? You can't. I mean, it's just not possible to be wrong that day. He was having one of those couldn't be wrong days, you know, and I said what I have heard you say, and I don't have to do this. We've been married, we'll be married 39 years in this August, not very long from now. And I met him when I came in AA, he came in after I did, and so I talk about that in a little bit. But I used these words, and I have, you know, I can't remember the last time I used it. I said, you could be right. And I thought, oh no. Now I'm using the words. You know, because I've heard that so many times, Al-Anon. So it's like, you could be right. Or, what's the other one? There's another one too, but I didn't have to use that. But I would say, I could be right. And I'll tell you something, it diffused the entire. I had to say it three times. In three different situations, but it completely diffused the situation because maybe he is right, you know, and maybe I'm the one who has to be right. You know, that's the way it goes. But we're both alcoholics, and I think it's a, It has, there's good things and bad things about being married to another alcoholic. The good thing, there's so many good things about it, but one of the best is that I know how he feels in his heart. I know how he felt in his heart. There isn't anything that he did that I haven't done or hadn't thought about doing. And right away, that puts a level of forgiveness in things that is just not possible to achieve in some relationships. So it's really nice. The bad thing about being married to another alcoholic is that we have these, you know, oppositional personalities. I mean, we are so opposite. I am very, very right-brained, and he's left-brained. He's very logical. He's very straightforward. He doesn't leap out with intuition at any given time, whereas I might strike off in one direction and never get back. You know, I just never get back. I think I'm going to get back, but I see something over there, and I think, that's curious, you know, and I go off over here, and then, you know, he gets me to work in the morning, is what I'm saying, because those kinds of people do. So we have had to learn to be grateful for each other's talents, and he has many. And yesterday when we got here, we were having an argument with the Scotts over who should take what bedroom, because the Scotts had a bedroom, and we had a bedroom, and they had very graciously given us the best bedroom. And it had a queen-size bed in it, but at night, Dick has a tendency to, in his dreams, ride horses, play soccer, which he had never played in his life, fight. He has fights in his dreams, and it's a little rough sleeping with him, you know, because he might think you're a soccer ball or something, you know, or he might gallop over you or something. So I was going to take the single bed, and anyway, I went to the door, and he said, I said, which room do you want? And he said, I don't care. And my face fell like this, and he goes, I care. And the expression on his face was so priceless. It was just priceless. Look, his glasses were off, so he couldn't see me very well. And it was like this little boy going, I care. So funny, and I find that delightful. But anyway, I'm not here to talk about him. He can talk about himself in the morning. I'm here to talk about me. You know, let's just put it in a nutshell. I was a weird kid. I always felt weird. I liked the only surcease I had from discomfort. I was uncomfortable in my own skin from as long back as I can remember. I was skinny and nervous and itchy and mean and, I just was squinty-eyed. You know, I was just like a Tasmanian devil. You know, I was just... You know how they go, there's a firework that looks just like that, those blooming flowers, you know, those things, you light those things, it goes like that. And that's, I just felt like that when I was a kid. And the only surcease I had from that was to smack somebody, you know, because I wasn't drinking yet. So I would just smack somebody, you know, and I got into fights and... I beat up a big fat kid in the sixth grade, you know, and I got in a lot of trouble because he was, you know, it wasn't good, you know, and I smacked him in the nose. I jumped on his back and crammed my fist up into his nose and brought him to the ground, and he was crying. And it was on the schoolyard ground. I mean, it was just a mess, you know. Mrs. Fletcher, your daughter's in trouble again, you know, and so they had to come, and I was grounded in my room, but I felt wonderful at that moment, you know, it was like, boom, you know, ooh. And I know now it was just a lot of endorphins, you know, went through my body and stuff. But it was only, you can't go around smacking people just to get feeling right, you know. You so I just felt like there was something. I was not in my right skin, you know. I mean, you know what I'm talking about? It's just weird. And I drink, and I'll tell you, it would go down, and it was just like, all right,
oh, I love everybody. I know why I'm here. You know, I felt like I had a purpose, and I get a figure, you know, I drink, and I was 13 or so, and my waist would get narrow, you know, and my stomach would suck in, and my hips would flare out, and my boobs would grow, you know, like this, boom, boom, and I was just like, Dolly Parton, you know, I'm walking around. And then I'd sober up, and they'd just be fried eggs on the sidewalk. It was magic. I was magic. I don't know, you know, when they had that thing, Betty Ford says, just say no, you know, and I thought, why? I mean, I was sober, and I was thinking, why would I have ever done that? If somebody comes up and says, just say no, don't drink anything, I'd have punched them. You know, no, why? This is wonderful. This is what I'm waiting for. And you know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our owner's manual, so to speak, it shows in that book everything, in my view, that makes us tick, before when we're drinking and after when we get sober. It's what makes us, it's our owner's manual. And in there it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. And then it talks about, well, that's exactly what this book is all about, to find that power. And my problem was, I did not have any power. I felt powerless. And I would have never told you that. I mean, look at me. I'm smacking people around, and I'm drinking, and I'm having a good time, but I've never told you that. But what I needed was some spirit. What I needed was something inside of me that I didn't. It was like a dynamo that I did not have. And I never had it. And today I have it. Sometimes to a greater extent than others, of course. But that's the spirit that we have. And instead of looking on the inside for the spirit, I took the spirit and put it inside. And because alcohol is spirits, and that's what I did. And I loved it. And I don't know, I have never heard of an alcoholic who says that they didn't like the effect produced by alcohol. Now, some of us don't like the taste of it. Some of us don't, you know. But I've never heard anybody say they didn't like the effect in the beginning. And I loved the effect in the beginning. And my father, we moved around a lot. I was in Texas a lot. I was in Missouri. I was in California. We were in England. And we were in Europe. When I started to drink on a regular basis, it was in Europe. And in Europe, I was in college. And I was in English girls' school for quite a while. And that was kind of a drag, you know, because I wasn't really drinking. And I didn't like it when I couldn't drink, but in college, I really began to drink on a regular basis. I went to the interpreter school in France. And in France, I began to drink wine on a regular basis. And I'd keep it in my room, and it was, you know, I think if I divided my story up into parts, it would be that in the beginning it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun. You couldn't have convinced me at that point that I needed to quit drinking for nothing. Then there's the middle part where it was fun, but there were some problems. You know, just problems. But you couldn't have convinced me even at that point that the problems were worth quitting over. You couldn't have, because it was, I don't know how you felt, but it was my life's blood. It was what made me able to walk out the door. I'm a depressive by nature. I know that's strange to say, but I am a depressive by nature. It is my nature to be depressed because I'm, you know, I used to say, anyone who has a brain would be depressed at the state of the world. I mean, anybody, a thinking woman, would be depressed. Look at this. This, that, whatever. I mean, there's always something you can find. And what alcohol did for me was it lifted my spirits. I wasn't depressed when I drank. And so in France, when I was drinking wine on a regular basis, I found a few things. One, when I drank, I could speak foreign languages with ease because it removed all my inhibitions. I could speak French. And I could, you know, one night I went out. I'm an artist also, so I like to talk in pictures. And I went out with this guy. And we were at the University of Geneva, and we were at a big celebration for their anniversary of some sort. And everybody, all the nations that were represented at this university had tents. And we all had, the Americans had fried chicken and apple pie and Coca-Cola, ho-hum, you know, I wouldn't even go near that tent. And the Germans had Rhine wine and beer, and that's where I went. And we pushed a case of wine out the back of the German's tent and dragged it into the bushes, and this Scotsman and I named Ian were sitting in the bushes drinking the wine, and we sat there all afternoon discussing whatever people discuss that are think they're intellectual. And by the time we got out from the bush, the last thing I really remember was he had on his kilt, because we were all supposed to dress up like our nations, and he had his kilt on. And I'd heard that they don't wear underwear under their kilts. And so the last I remember, I was walking down the sidewalk, flipping up the back of his kilt with a stick, trying to see if he had any underwear on. And like most of my experiences like that, that's the last thing I remember. So I don't know whether he had any underwear on or not. And recently, we were in Scotland last year at an AA conference, we were speaking, and they had a whole bunch of guys in kilts around me, and they're hard to understand, some of them, but I understood this. Dunna give her any sticks. Dunna give her any sticks. So I came out of the blackout with an Italian speaking fluent Italian, with Giorgio, who was an Italian pharmacist. How handy. And he was saying something to me about having to go to Mass the next morning, and I ended up in Mass with him. And you remember those mornings when you're so hungover that, I mean, you're just, wine will do that anyway. You know, you're just like, don't speak. You know, I mean, the hair is standing up on your arms and your liver, you know, is out to here, and you've just got the, you know, just pounding, terrible headache. And I call them brownouts. You can't exactly, not a blackout, but, because you sort of remember, but you really don't want to remember. You didn't wish you weren't in a brownout. But I was in a brownout, and he came and got me. We went to Mass at this, and then guys with these long robes on, and they're swinging things, and smoke's everywhere, and they got lace bibs on them. And I mean, he says, you got to go to confession. I didn't know why. I mean, I couldn't remember what I'd done to have to go to confession. Because I'm not Catholic. And I'm in this big Mass, and I'm not Catholic. And I just turned to him, and I said, I'm sick. And I'm not Catholic. And I don't know which was worse, the fact that I had committed whatever sin it was the night before, or I wasn't Catholic. I don't know. But those are the kinds of things I got myself into. That fun was trouble. And then the last of my drinking was nothing but trouble. And it was what I call dog drinking. Like the dog days, it's dog drinking. And I just drank and drank. By then, I had to drink. I had to drink. And my drink of choice was a fifth of pop-off vodka, which is awful vodka. I mean, I think it's 80 proof. I mean, all I know was that it was $2 and some odd cents a quart. And I used to buy it by the quart. And I would, I'd try to get out on a daily basis and get me a quart of vodka. And towards the end of my drinking, which in my dog drinking, I was living with my folks in Washington, D.C. My father was a high mucky muck, and they were sort of hiding me in their attic because he was working for General LeMay, and you didn't have problems in your family if you worked for General LeMay. So he was kind of hiding me out, my sister decided that I looked road hard and put up wet, and that I needed to have something done with my hair. So she sat me down on a shower curtain, and she pulled my hair. I'm not a girly girl. I'm a football girl. I love football. I love everything about football. To me, football's like a ballet. You know, it's just like a very aggressive ballet. I just love it. I love all the plays. I love the players. I love the hits. I love the passing. I love the whole thing. And I'm not a girly girl. So she's sitting there pulling this stuff through this shower cap and putting this stuff on my hair. And she says, "We're frosting your hair so you can look better. Maybe if you look better, you'll act better," kind of. And what I didn't know then, and I know now, is that when having as much alcohol in my system as I had in my system at that time, on an all-time basis, your hair is a protein pathway, and the alcohol goes to your hair. It goes right down to the ends of your hair. And my hair had died a year before or something. It just looked like shredded wheat all over my head. It was all broken off and sticking out all over the place, and it didn't have, it's bad enough now, but it didn't have any texture. It just went, and I remember those, do you remember those tiny bows that people used to put in the side of their heads like this? They put them on babies now. I think it's the dorkiest looking thing in the world, because they stick these bows on these poor babies. It's going to give them a complex. You wait and see when they grow up. But these little tiny bows are on the sides of their heads here, on our heads. And my right-hand side bow and hair was always smashed flat, because that was my passing out side. I'd pass out on that side every time, because your heart's up here. So your heart it's protecting your heart. Because if you pass out on this side, your heart can still beat. But if you pass out on the other side, the way we pass out, I mean, we're gone, aren't we? I mean, we're flat, gone. We wake with our mouths cemented to the pavement and stuff. You know what I mean? I mean, we're gone when we're passed out. So your body adjusts to that. So I passed on the right side with this blow fat over here. So I always walked around with this flat head on one side, dead hair sticking up all over the place. And I tried to put on makeup, and because nobody ever visited me, but I would think they were going to visit me. I was really pathetic. And so I would get myself ready, for people to visit. So I try to put on makeup, but I never took off the makeup I had on before. So I would, I had these big, it was two big, huge, enormous tarantula spiders just sat down on my forehead like this. And these lashes were so heavy, and they go, and my eyes were just slow, pass out over here, and I'd wake up, and this eye would be like glued shut with that stuff, you know, and I'm blind, one eye. I was just an animal, and my sister, that's how bad I am on the outside, but inside, I'm just as drunk as my hair, you know. I mean, it's just all through your whole body. You have all these neurons in your body. They're everywhere. We all have neurons, and they come. They're these little bips, you know, that are. This is not genetically exactly right, but if you think of it this way, it is accurate. But they're not called blips or anything. But they're called these nerve cells. They're neurons. I don't know. And they're coursing through our bodies all the time. And they come together, they are hooked together at synapses, which is like a little bridge thing. So you've got two clumps of these neurons, and then here's the synapse. And these neuron thing, these bundles, have arms that reach out to one another like this. They go, and they create electricity. And so we walk, and we talk, and we remember where we parked the car, and we breathe. I mean, things like that. These things function, and the whole thing is what, I mean, it keeps us going. Well, these neurons, they don't like alcohol. And so when we drink, these things go, and the alcohol goes up through here, you know, they go, eek, eek, eek. They map these people. They can map these they map them neurologically. There's a bunch of little bright things in there, and they're screaming, eek, like that. They pull back, and so the electrical spark, which is supposed to be conducted across these synapses, goes, and it fries the ends of these things. So we have fried brains. When you say you're fried, you're right. Because you are, as I was. Now, if you smoked a little doobie along with that, what you get is, and they're like glued back. Instead of being fried, they're like ossified at the ends of these things. So alcoholics who also have smoked dope or whatever are very slow. We, those of us who didn't do that, are extremely quick. And by that I mean, my arm, I'd be sitting in the front of the meeting where John is, and my arm would go, just like that. Or if I had crossed my legs like that, my other leg involuntarily would go, boing, out, and I'd jerk like this. And when I tried to put, remember when you were drinking, you tried to put, the older ones of us remember, when you had to put ice cube trays, you had to put the tray thing back in the ice cube tray and put it back in the freezer. And I'd start out like this, and then I'd get like, they'd just shake all over and knock all the water out of it. Well, you know, that's, when I was sobered up, I would get it almost there, and then I'd go, whoops, and then the whole thing would go over on it. It took me a long time to get better physically. But if it does that to your head with all these, think of what it does to your hair. So my hair, when she put this stuff on it, and don't you guys sit back there. I mean, there's been a time when you all have tried a little peroxide here and there. I'm telling you about it. Dry your hair blue and all that stuff on, look hip, slick, and cool. But anyway, she put this stuff on my hair, and she goes, oh, something's wrong. Oh, my God. She said, let me put some more on. So she put some more on. And the net result of it was that it turned bright bozo orange. So now, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous several weeks later. and I looked like a hyena. I mean, I had dark hair, dad dark hair, with these big, huge orange blobs all over my head. And then it would start to fall out because it was dead anyway, so I'd start to scratch it, and it would itch. So I'd go, and I mean, I was tested with an IQ of 172, and I'm walking around, and then they all fell out, so I had these big holes, bald spots all over my head, and that's not a pretty picture, but it's an alcoholic. I mean, that's where I got to. That's what I looked like. I'll tell you what happened was I was given the greatest gift I've ever been given. I was given the gift of desperation. And it's not something that you would want. I mean, would you rather have a Christmas present or the greatest thing in your whole life? Desperation. You know, no. I don't want it. Nobody wants to be desperate. My daughter-in-law, the other night, we were in the women's meeting once a month. We have a women's meeting on Thursday night. And I'm a meeting maker. I love making meetings because I think meeting makers make it eventually. You know, you may still be drinking, but just keep coming back because eventually meeting makers make it. And she said, we have a little speaker meeting at the end. So we have 150 women in that meeting. And at the end of the month, in the first part of the month, it's a literature study. We study the big book. And at the end of the month, we have a call. We have a call-up meeting. We take a ticket, and they draw the tickets. And so we get to hear each other at the end of the month. And this month was on step 7, which has been very large in my life over the last couple of years. And my daughter-in-law got the one that says, about character building, you know, doing these things and taking these steps so that we can have character building. And she said, oh, isn't it awful when you take a problem to your sponsor and your sponsor says, this is a perfect opportunity for character building. And she says, of course you want to please them, so you say, oh, yes, I'm so happy to be character building. I just jump for joy to character build because building character is not fun. It's tough, you know, and she was so funny about that, but that's exactly how I feel. At any rate, my mom and dad threw me in a treatment center. They threw me in a drying out place. It wasn't a treatment center like you want, and I was like we would have today. We were in there for 30 days, and I got dried out. I was in there with the wife of the Speaker of the House and a Pulitzer Prize winner. I got sober in Washington, D.C., so I was in this drying out place in the country with a lot of relatively, not renowned so much, but accomplished people. And of those people, there were 26 of us in there, and of those people, I am the only one who stayed sober all the way to this day. And that is, I believe, because I had the gift of desperation. They still had something left to lose. Remember the old song, Janis Joplin? Nothing left to, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And I'll tell you, they had something left to lose. And I had nothing left to lose. I had nothing left. And I'll tell you, right at that moment, in my experience, right at that moment, when we have nothing, you know, I didn't have a single better idea. I'd been thinking my way out of stuff like this. I'd been thinking my way out of situations and out of problems for a long time. And I didn't have a single better answer. I didn't have a single answer, much less a better. I didn't have a single answer to what was going on. I didn't know. I was out of ideas. Done. Whooped. I had a red McGinnis surrender. You know, I mean, I was just done. But you know what? In retrospect, I didn't surrender. I didn't. the way I surrender to character defects today is, I go like this. Okay. All right. I'll follow your suggestion. And in my head I'm going, until I prove it doesn't work. That's how I surrender. I am German and I fight to the end. I mean, we're just... I love this. My mother, she does have Alzheimer's, but she might as well have. And do you know, well, I mean, she's 93. She deserves it. You know, she's lived a long life. She's got a boyfriend, even. But anyway, I'll tell you about her in a minute. But you know what Irish Alzheimer's is? You forget everything but the resentments. I think it's German's Alzheimer's, too, because, you know, those are the things that we remember. But anyway... So I got thrown in this place, and I was desperate, and they took us out to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got sober in the Washington, D.C. area, and this woman walked up to me at one of the first meetings I went to, and she said, "My name is Jane Holler, and I'll be your sponsor. You look new." Well, I was horrified. I mean, I had gotten dressed up to come to this meeting, but I looked like a hyena. I mean, I had all this stuff hanging out. I got a frog face, you know. I got skinny legs and skinny arms and a fluffy body, you know. You get these. My liver was way out here because I had portal cirrhosis of the liver. You know, I look and you look in my eyes. And it's like I alternate between being a dog on the freeway, like this, or nobody home. And all you have to do is look in people's eyes, and you can tell. I mean, you look around here, I've seen some people this weekend, and it's none of my business because they're not, I don't know them, but I know they're in pain. You can look in people's eyes and tell they're in pain. You can look in people's eyes and tell when they have a problem with depression or with whatever. Nobody has to tell me. You don't have to. This is the intuition that the big book is talking about. Now, I don't act on it, because if you act on your intuitions, you sometimes get locked up because they're not always right, you know. But in here, this is a safe, well-lighted place. We don't shoot wounded here. And that's good. Because we'd all be shot. Because we're all wounded in some way. Some of us are like this because we have to protect ourselves. Some of us don't let anybody in. You know, there's the wall, you know, that wall. Because we don't want anybody in. Some of us are scared. And it's like that little thing of fear. The worm of fear is in your eye. You know, some of us are braving it out, you know, or whatever. But this is the place we bring our broken toys. It's where we bring our broken selves. And it's the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that welcomes us. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my experience, under the direction of members of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, will help us live and out there, and nobody knows how nuts we are sometimes. We can go to work. We can act like grown-ups. I mean, do you ever go to your office or your place of business and think, if they only knew... I go and I sit, and I own part of this business, and I sit behind that desk and I think, I want my mommy. You know, and my mommy, she knows me, but not much else. You know, you know what I'm saying? You know, it's the feeling. So I pick up my phone, I call my sponsor, or I talk to Dick, or I call one of my pigeons, or they call me, or something, and it. That's my nature. That's always going to be my nature. But I've been given a wonderful fellowship of people, and the tools administered by that fellowship of people to get better. And I've gotten better. You know, in the beginning, when I was first sober, just a very tiny bit of history, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was being de-emphasized on the East Coast of this country, 1964, because there was a huge, big, you know how AA is, we just share a lot. And there was this big controversy going on because Bill Wilson wrote the big book and he was getting royalties from the big book, and there were people who were, I think, frankly, jealous because he was getting a little money. He was actually the writer of the big book. He should have been given some, but they were upset that he was getting these royalties and blah, blah, blah. So on the East Coast, they were de-emphasizing the use of the big book. So the first book that I read in Alcoholics Anonymous was Marty Mann's Primer on Alcoholism. And it was a wonderful, wonderful book, and it was, I think, a great godsend to me because when I first got here, I didn't believe in God. I probably would not have understood the big book at all, but I could believe in the scientific and the medical aspects of alcoholism, and that's what Marty Mann's Primer talked about, was the medical aspects of alcoholism. It was very heavy on that medical aspects of alcoholism. And someone years later gave me a first edition of that book, which I have at home, and I'm very grateful for that. The other book was a little book that was put out by Hazelden, and I have no opinion on these things. It's just that that's my experience. And it was the 24-hour day book, the 24-hour book. And in the front, still to this day, in the 24-hour book, it says that we see things through a glass darkly. And I remember thinking, after my brain cleared a little bit, that's my life. I can look back at that woman that was and know that she is me. It's me. Hyena, lost hair, fluffy body, the whole thing. That's me. But it's like she's some distant relative of mine. And as long as I remember that I have her in me, I'll still learn and grow. It's when I think she's gone completely that I'm in trouble. Because I, you know, 10, 15 years ago, they came through our town of Bellevue and they put in a freeway. And they had these massive bulldozers come down through town. And they plowed out the farm fields and they shoved this dirt up on the sides of the freeway and they laid ribbons of concrete down that way and put trees and stuff in. And it looked entirely different than it had. But it was the same dirt. They didn't import dirt. And that's me. I have the same cellular genetic makeup that I had then. And at the back of my brain, there's a little brain about this big around, which is the original brain, called the medulla. And the medulla carries in it every single piece of genetic information that we have. All of us have a medulla. And in this medulla is our hair color, our eye color, our skin tones, the whole thing. And it carries our DNA, every single piece of it. I think of my original brain as a lizard because it has the characteristics of a lizard. And lizards... No, I don't want to argue with anybody about procreation or anything, okay? I don't. But that's a very similar brain to the lizard. And lizards crawled out onto the ocean shore and eventually transmogrified into people who stood up and so forth. Lizards, those little creatures, started out that way. And that's how far back that ancient brain is. It's the lizard. And the lizard talks to me. And he says, why do you need to go to that Monday night meeting? It's, you know, Mr. On and On is going to be there, and he's going to go on and on and on and on about the same thing. You, my God, do you have to go to that meeting? I mean, can't you? You've been sober 41 years. Why do you have to go to that meeting? You can skip it once in a while. Skip it tonight. So, you know, I think about it, and it doesn't matter how much I think about it. But I think, well, I better go get in the car. So I get in the car, and all the way down there I'm thinking, I'm going to the movies. I'm going shopping. I'm going to go get me a dress. I don't get any time. I'm taking care of all these old people. I'm going to get me a dress. But I got a dumb head, but a smart car. And that car just turns right into that parking lot and screeches to a halt in the parking space. And my feet, which are the smartest part of my body, get out. And by the time I get out of my car, somebody's going, "Hi, how are you tonight? Good Monday." And I go, "Yes, I'm just so glad to be here," you know. And I get myself into the meeting. So I got a dumb head and a smart car and smart feet. And that's what I do. I don't need that. So Cindy was talking about, you know, I don't want to listen. I don't want to listen to this. Because it's dark in there sometimes. I mean, it's a foreign neighborhood sometimes. You know, I need sponsor guidance to get through this neighborhood. Even today, I do. Several years ago, the sponsor that I'd had for 27 years died. And, I mean, I miss her to this day because she'd sponsored me for 27 years. And she was like me. She was a doctor's daughter and an artist, and she loved to exercise and all the things that I loved. And I just had so much in common with her, and I really, really missed her. And she was also such, she was never, ever pious. She was always just like a little spitfire. She was never woo-woo, you know. She never floated above the floor or anything, you know. She was practical. She'd say, you know, get down on your knees, do this, sit in your chair, put your arms on the handles of your chair, and rise above this situation, you know, and all very practical things. And I missed her, but I knew very well that I needed to get myself a sponsor right away. Well, I'm 40. I was 39 years sober, something like that, when she died. It's not a lot of 39 years sober, better than 39 years sober women, active in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had to look all over the place to find somebody. And I found a woman in Virginia, or close to D.C. Matter of fact, next weekend I'll have lunch. Dick and I will have lunch with Marianne and her husband, and I asked her to sponsor me. And I'm building a relationship with her because my brain is my own worst enemy. My feet are my best. My actions are the things that I... You know what? I want to talk about this. I want to talk about a man's and we'll shut up. When I first got sober, my sponsor said to me, "You sit up in the front row because you're a twit." She had hurt my feelings all the time. You know, I mean, she didn't, you know, she just, "You're a twit, you'll sit in the front row, then if you get up and try to escape, I can trip you up, you know. You'll sit in the front row because you've got the concentration of a gnat, and you need to be facing the speaker and concentrate on their eyes and their mouth and try to listen to what they say," because I was twitchy, you know. I mean, I was boo, boo, boo. And, she said, "I want you to get a service job in this. You go out there and greet." And I said, "I don't want to greet. I don't like people." And she said, "I don't care if you like people or not. I didn't ask you whether you like people. I want you to greet. So go home and practice." And I'd go home and I'd practice in front of this mirror that I used to get naked in front of. When I was drinking, I used to take off all my clothes. Fortunately, not in public, but in my room, and I thought I was a ballerina, and I would be drunk, and I'd be leaping around in front of this mirror and have on this classical music blasting, you know, to the top of it, and I had this full-length thing, and leaping around,
So I was full of bruises when I got sober because it was not my forte, I guess, ballet. Went home and I started practicing in front of this mirror. Welcome. Welcome to the friendship group. That was the name of my group, which I thought was a joke. You know, welcome to the friendship group. We're glad you're here. And I wasn't glad that they were there at all, but that's what she told me to say. So I was welcome to the friendship group. She said, I want you to go to a meeting every night for 6 weeks. And then when, at the end of 6 weeks, I'll tell you whether you have to go to a meeting or not. So I, you know, with my busy social schedule, I said, well, I don't know if I can do that. She says, you're not even working. You can go to a meeting every day for 6 weeks. And I did. Strange thing is, just recently, for reasons really obscure, I thought, I'm just going to go to a meeting every night for a week and see how it works. I haven't done it in a long time. I think I'll just do it. And I did. And you know what? I went to a meeting every night for 3 weeks in a row. And for a month in a row, I've only missed one time. And I feel great. So what worked for me in the beginning to help me stay sober works for me now in my head. She said, I want you to wash cups with Crazy Frank. And I said, I don't want to wash cups with Crazy Frank. He's crazy. And I'm scared of him. He's really big and tall, and he glowers at me. And she said, I don't care. Think of something to talk to him about. So here I am with this guy who's 6'6", and we're out washing cups. We had real cups and stuff in those days with saucers and everything, and we're washing cups and saucers in the kitchen. And I look up at him, I go, so Frank, it must be nice for you being so tall. And he said, why? You know, kind of. I said, well, you're a painter, aren't you? He said, yeah. I said, you probably don't have to use a ladder to paint the ceilings. And he goes, like that's his laugh, you know. And I go, whoa, he's not so bad after all, you know. And we're the best cup washing team ever. And then just when you get good at something in AA, they take it away from you and you have to go be on ashtrays or something, you know, that you don't want to do. So those are the kinds of things that we did. We went on lots of road trips. Today, I'm still a greeter. You know, I greet on a rotating basis. In my home group, which is Tuesday night, I greet on a rotating basis. And I was with a guy from work release named Manny, who had made an unscheduled stop in the state of Nebraska on Interstate 80 and was captured by... Oh, my God. Sorry, dear. He's looking at me like it's my fault. It's not my fault. Nothing's ever my fault. There you go.